I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, wild things in the city and what they can teach us about surviving climate change. We'll spend this hour with Wired contributing editor Brendan I. Kerner, who's been reporting on surprising discoveries by scientists that some animals living in polluted, crowded, thoroughly built human areas have quickly evolved adaptations that give them a better shot at survival, more than their cousins in the wilderness would have. We'll talk with Kerner about the mechanisms behind such rapid evolution and how we can use what researchers are learning to guide conservation efforts as the planet heats up. Our conversation starts after a short break. Fable about the city mouse and the country mouse, neither much cares for the life of the other. The urban rodent turns up his nose at his cousin's simple life and humdrum dining options. The creature from the wilderness is terrified by the crowds and the dangers of the city. Each, it seems, is better suited to the place he already lives. It's just a story, of course, and Aesop was more interested in moral lessons than scientific ones. But it turns out he might have been onto something. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. After long passing up studies of urban animals in favor of far-flung wilderness destinations, some scientists are taking a closer look at the creatures for whom the concrete jungle is now a natural habitat. They're discovering how quickly certain animals are evolving to thrive in these environments and hoping what they learn might be useful in helping more species survive a rapidly changing climate. Brendan I. Kerner is a contributing editor at Wired and author of the article, How Cities Reshape the Evolutionary Path of Urban Wildlife. Brendan, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I want to start with Newark Bay, New Jersey. It was, in your words, treated like a toilet by surrounding chemical plants for a very long time. Just how dirty was it allowed to get before people started paying attention?
It's tough to imagine a dirtier place in America, at least back in the early 1980s. In 1983, the governor of New Jersey was forced to declare a state of emergency because the dioxin levels in the bay by the Passaic River were so high, mostly due to the fact that there was a plant up on the river that made Agent Orange, the defoliant from the Vietnam War, and was pumping out all sorts of byproducts into the water. So it was really nasty. And there's been some small attempt at cleanup, but it's still a very thorny problem. There's a Superfund site up there on the river.
What's astonishing is that there are still animals alive in Newark Bay. What sort of creature is the Atlantic killifish?
The Atlantic killifish is kind of a small little silvery minnow, not something you'd probably think a lot of if you saw it in an aquarium, but it's a fascinating creature. And the chief reason I was attracted to it and wrote about it in my story for Wired magazine is that it's actually evolved a way to thrive in these waters that are soaked through with these cancer-causing dioxins. It actually is a genetic change within the killifish genome that allows it to basically not be fooled by this chemical. The way the chemical, kind of commits its evil is by tricking the body into making development of embryo spin out of control. So you have lots of deformities and deaths in the womb. And in these killifish who've evolved this genetic defense against this dioxin, they basically don't get tricked by that anymore. Their pathways in their genome don't listen to the dioxin at all, and they are able to thrive and have huge populations in these very poisonous waters.
But if I took a killifish that had been born and raised and lived its life in a relatively clean body of water, it would die in Newark Bay.
It would either die or it would never have children, so its population would not be able to go beyond for more generations. So it's pretty incredible what these killifish are able to do. In just a matter of a few decades, actually, they've evolved this resistance to this really nasty poison.
But most of us have been taught that evolution takes eons, millennia, to actually have any effect on the bodies of populations. How have we learned that things are able to evolve so quickly?
Yeah, so actually Darwin himself believed that. Charles Darwin in 1859 and on the Origin of Species wrote that, it would take, hundreds or thousands of years for these changes to occur via natural selection. And therefore, we don't really see them or don't really understand them because we don't have the perspective in our human lifetimes. But, in the decades, even after he passed away, you had his disciples, the first generations of biologists. They were looking around themselves in industrial Britain, starting to see more rapid changes than their mentor had taught them. And I think that ever since, there's been a real interest in trying to gauge the maximum velocity of evolution, as it were. And what we've discovered by looking at the animals that surround us in cities, which are such high-pressure, high-stress environments, we found that evolution is occurring much more rapidly than we ever anticipated.
The first thing that Darwin's disciples, his protégés, started to look at was moths in England in the 19th century. How did peppered moths' bodies start to change in and around big cities?
Yeah, so in the 19th century, people who studied moths started to realize that there were many, many more moths who had this mutation for black bodies, black coloration, black melanin in their bodies. And it was a pretty dramatic shift. In about a half century, it went from 95% white moths with only 5% with this genetic mutation for the darker body type to flipping that 95% of these darker moths, and only a small number had the white bodies anymore. And there were a lot of theories as to why this was happening. A big one was, well, there's a lot of coal, soot being pumped into the air, and that's somehow tarnishing the wings, and that's what's happening. But you know, after a while, it became apparent that this was probably the result of natural selection. The fact that moths, you know, their big challenge is avoiding being eaten by birds. And because so many of the trees near industrial centers were turning black because of the soot, the white ones stood out and were gobbled up by the birds. And the black ones who had this mutation, they survived and they were able to pass that mutation down to their progeny. So it was really kind of the first instance of challenging Darwin's contention that evolution was something that took centuries or millennia. It was the first time that biologists said, hey, this could take only a matter of decades instead.
So Bernard Kettlewell at Oxford decided to do an experiment on this.
Yes, he did. And this was actually not until the 1950s. This is a very famous experiment where he basically spent 3 years releasing moths of both types into two different forests in England. One near the industrial city of Birmingham, where there was a kind of a forest that was still ravaged by the scars of industrialization, and one by the southern coast in a very pristine forest. And he tracked these moths for many, many months and wrote a very famous paper in 1955 talking about his discovery. And he basically confirmed what had only been a hypothesis till then, that this was a result of natural selection. And that's really, I think, maybe the foundational paper of the study of rapid evolution in this day and age.
So for a long time, evolutionary biologists felt like they needed to be as far away from urban areas as possible, right? So how did Jason Munchie South find himself focused on mice in New York City instead of tree shrews in Borneo?
Yeah, so you make a good point that there was a political dynamic to the study of biology, and people who were pursuing doctorates, you know, these are people who in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, grew up with Jane Goodall being an idol of theirs, and Wild Kingdom, seeing nature documentaries on TV about leopards and cheetahs and elephants and these exotic animals they would never see growing up in the Midwestern suburbs, say. And so there was kind of this institutional bias almost that if you wanted to be taken seriously as a biologist, you had to do your doctoral work and your postdoc work in the most far-flung exotic places possible. That basically you had to go to Borneo or to, you know, some little trafficked corners of the globe to study animals that most people will never encounter in their lives. And that's certainly what a biologist, as you mentioned, Jason Munchie South did in his doctoral and postdoc work. But you know, then he got a professorship at Baruch College here in New York City. It's in Manhattan, definitely the opposite of Borneo in many ways, completely built up, almost a total lack of what we might call a wild environment. but he still had this itch. You know, he saw this itch to do field work. He saw this itch to work with wildlife. And he asked himself, well, where do I find wildlife being in New York City? And he learned that there's actually these populations of these white-footed mice that live in some of these urban parks in New York. And he said, well, you know, I've got a young child at home, so I can't really go on any long expeditions, but I can take the subway to these parks in, say, the Bronx and collect these mice and snip off little pieces of their tails and analyze their DNA to find out maybe, you know, how are they related to each other, to other mice throughout New York City? How are they related to mice who live in the countryside, which is kind of the native land for these mice? And as he did that, he started to discover some really interesting things about how the genomes of these mice were actually quite radically different from those of their country cousins. And that kind of set off a light bulb above his head saying, like, you know what? Like, the future of studying evolutionary biology is not in these exotic locales, which a lot of times are under threat from climate change or human activity. It's in cities, because a feature of the world, of the human economy right now, is that we're building more and more urban areas. Let's try to find out. Let me devote myself to trying to find out how this human activity in urban areas is affecting the genomes of all sorts of wildlife.
My guest is Brendan Koerner, a contributing editor at Wired magazine. We're talking about his recent article, How Cities Reshape the Evolutionary Path of Urban Wildlife. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Wired magazine contributing editor Brendan I. Koerner. We're talking about his article, How Cities Reshape the Evolutionary Path of Urban Wildlife. So Jason Munchie South started with white-footed mice in New York City, moved on to brown rats, and discovered, sure enough, that they had evolved, these brown rats in the city had evolved a different sense of smell than their rural cousins. Why might that be a useful adaptation in the city?
Yeah, so Jason Munchie South found that the olfactory sensors within the noses of these brown rats who inhabit New York City were pretty radically different from those who inhabit more country environments. And his hypothesis is that it has to do with navigation of the subterranean passages where the rats exist here in the city. Clearly they're living in sewers, they're living in subway tunnels, this whole network, this whole kind of city within a city that we've built here beneath New York City is where rats flourish. And they have pretty, characteristic and unique smells due to chemicals that are down there and the nature of our garbage and what we throw away. And so having uniquely shaped olfactory sensors will therefore help these rats find their ways around in these pitch black environments.
So you also met up with Elizabeth Carlin, who studies pigeons. We see them in just about every city in America, but she realized there was a lot we actually didn't know about them.
Yeah, this blew me away when I found this out, because obviously pigeons are a fact of life for all of us who are in any kind of urban environment. But we don't really think about them. They're just kind of like our quiet partners there on city streets. And what I found out is that no one's really done any in-depth studies of pigeons in urban environments. We don't even know, say, what their average lifespan is, what their average range is, how far they roam from where they live. There are all these unanswered questions because they've never really been a topic of serious academic inquiry until very recently. And Elizabeth Carlin's really at the forefront of trying to find out everything she can, not only about the behavior of these pigeons, but how different populations are related to one another and what their genetic adaptations are to city life.
She wants to understand how pigeons in the 21st century can eat such a high-carb diet and not get sick. This is really interesting because they're eating like discarded French fries and bread and donuts and that sort of thing.
Yeah, specifically things with sugar in them. So one thing she's found is that pigeons really gravitate not just towards carbohydrates, but carbohydrates that are sweet, discarded cookies, donuts, all sorts of things like that. And interestingly, she's found that when she tests their blood sugar levels in the city environments, they do not have elevated blood sugar. They don't suffer from hyperglycemia, which you would think given how much sugar they consume in relation to their body weight. And so her hypothesis is that there is genetic adaptation that they've developed that helps them process this high sugar diet that might be lethal to their country kin.
Elizabeth Carlin's best friend is another scientist named Kristen Winchell, who has compared the bodies of lizards in Puerto Rican cities to the bodies of the same species living in the forest. How are they different?
Yeah, so this is maybe one of the most vivid examples of urban evolution I've encountered. So she went down to Puerto Rico and caught lizards in two very different kind of environments, one in rainforest environments and the other in very highly urbanized cities. And she could actually tell with her naked eye that these lizards caught in the cities had elongated limbs and thicker pads on their toes. And so she wanted to find out, well, what might be the reason for this? Why would a lizard in the city want to have this adaptation? So she came up with a really clever solution. She organized a series of sprint races where she built these tracks out of very common building materials from Puerto Rican cities, cement and aluminum and all sorts of things like that. And she would race these lizards against one another, timing them and seeing which ones were fastest. And invariably, the lizards from the cities were faster. And so her hypothesis is that these longer limbs and thicker toe pads help the lizards sprint across open areas where they'd be vulnerable to predators, such as feral cats. In a forest, it's really easy for a lizard to hide beneath a log, or there's not a lot of open area where they're, you know, incredibly visible to potential predators. In cities, that's not the case. If they have to skitter across a pretty vast open expanse of concrete, you know, a bird or a cat could pounce on them at any moment. So being faster is something that's been passed down from successful individuals to future generations.
So how was she able to demonstrate that they actually have evolved to be faster rather than just being perhaps better athletes because their lifestyle in the city puts them at risk and causes them to sort of work out more often and therefore change the shape of their bodies?
Sure. And this is a very important distinction in evolutionary biology because not everything is a product of natural selection. Not adaptations are natural selection. There's also a phenomenon called plasticity. And this is basically, as you mentioned, if you're in a situation where you have to act a certain way, your body then changes in relation to that. I guess a great example is people who are bodybuilders. You know, of course, their physiques change as they're putting stress in their muscles. It doesn't mean that when they have children, that those children are automatically also going to have huge muscles. And so what Kristen Winchell did is she conducted what's called a common garden experiment, a very traditional and important step in evolutionary biological research. This basically consists of taking the lizards from the country and lizards from the city, you know, having them have children, getting their eggs, having them hatch children, then raising those children completely independent of one another, but in identical environments. So she would take the babies once they'd hatched, put them in separate cages where they couldn't see each other, had no mixing at all, the city and the country progeny. But those cages had the exact same environments, you know, very specifically down to the temperature within a degree at all times. And she did indeed find that the city lizards that were born in these environments did have the same elongated limbs and thicker toe pads of their parents.
So some of these adaptations are really hopeful as the planet is changing, as more and more areas are paved over and developed by human activity. But we know that not every animal and plant species is able to adapt and evolve so quickly. What's different about the ones that seem to be changing rapidly to accommodate changes in their environments?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's a very small percentage of animals, of species that are going to be able to adapt to these urban environments that we're creating and that are going to be very much affected by climate change. And we don't yet know really what makes these kind of evolutionary winners the winners that they are. We don't know what it is about specifically their genes. But we have some guesses, and I think a big one is about genetic variation within their genomes. That's basically looking at a genome of an animal, you know, how many kind of traits do they have in their genomes that aren't typically expressed? How many genes do they have that just aren't expressed? You know, it's tough. Climate change is happening at such a rapid rate. You don't really have time if you're a population of particular species to wait around for a beneficial mutation, which is just purely by chance, to be spread by natural selection. What you need is individuals who have beneficial traits within their genomes already that haven't traditionally been expressed. And so climate change and urbanization bring those traits to the fore. And I think a great example is the killifish we talked about at the top of the show. They have a lot of genetic variation in their genomes. And it's thought that they probably have this ability to turn off the pathways that are affected by dioxin in their genomes already. And, you know, existing in those poisonous waters brought that to the fore. So that's one trait we think that they might have. But we really are at the infancy of this research, of urban evolution research. And it's also a big reason why so many of the most prominent researchers are people at the very beginning of their career, people in their 20s and early 30s who are PhD students and postdocs. This is a very young field.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 800-933-5372. First up, we have Peter calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question for the guest is really his opinion. Could it have been that prior to the 1500s that environmental changes happened so slowly that Darwin was somewhat fooled to think that also species changes would also be slow? I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks for calling.
I do think that's an excellent point. It's clear that the environment is shifting much more rapidly than in previous centuries and millennia due to human activity, that human activity has now become the primary driver of evolution for so many species. So, yes, that's certainly possible that Darwin, even in, you know, Victorian England, probably couldn't anticipate just how much human activity would affect evolution. So, you know, even though he was among industrialization and soon after his passing, we had his disciples understanding how, you know, the burning of coal was affecting moths in England. He certainly could not have envisioned a century or a century and a half later just how much we're altering the planet with human activity.
All right, next on the phone, we'll speak with Allison in Dallas. Hi, Allison.
Hi, I was wondering how you can look at animal DNA and determine different factors within a city and show how the city evolved.
Well, the city's not evolving, it's the animals evolving, right, Brendan?
Yeah, that's correct. But it's a great question because this is a big part of it, is that the reason that this research is possible right now is because DNA technology has become so much more accessible for researchers. You know, when Jason Munchie South was starting out looking at white-footed mice, you know, over a decade ago, you know, he had to do a lot of workarounds. He did something called transcriptome analysis because he couldn't afford to do, you know, genetic analysis, genome analysis. So he had to kind of do a workaround looking at RNA instead of DNA. But, you know, in the course of him working on this and these young researchers coming up, analyzing DNA has become much more affordable, much more accessible. And I look at someone like, say, Elizabeth Carlin. She took me to her laboratory at Fordham here in New York City. And just the way that she is able to go and collect blood samples from pigeons in the Bronx and take them to a lab and be analyzing them and sequencing them within 24 to 48 hours for a reasonable cost is a lot of what's making this research possible.
So can they look at those DNA samples and know about changes that aren't necessarily obvious to someone just observing a pigeon and its behaviors?
They certainly can, but it's a long process because obviously then you have to compare them to you know, other pigeon populations. You have to account for a lot of variables. It's involved, and that's why I think people specialize in one animal and really dedicate significant chunks of their career to understanding a specific species at the genetic level. It's something you have to dedicate yourself to body and soul for maybe a decade or more to really get a grip on what's going on with these animals and how they're evolving in these urban environments.
My guest is Brendan I. Kerner. He's a contributing editor at Wired. We're talking about his article, How Cities Reshape the Evolutionary Path of Urban Wildlife. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with Wired contributing editor Brendan I. Kerner about his recent article, How Cities Reshape the Evolutionary Path of Urban Wildlife. Brendan, is there some way biologists think they might be able to nudge evolution for certain species to allow them to adapt rather than die off in response to changes?
In some respects, yes. So I think that the end game for a lot of this research is to be able to peer inside the genomes of animals and understand which ones have the capacity to continue to thrive in urban environments, in places that are going to be hotter and hotter, and which ones are going to be vulnerable and therefore have to be the targets of conservation efforts. So I feel that for the latter kinds of species, you know, we can look at animals and say, well, these animals are not going to thrive, not going to do well as we kind of bulldoze over their native habitats and things get 7 to 9 degrees hotter due to climate change. We need to find a way to maybe transport them to different places, you know, try to have some kind of elaborate conservation efforts. But the flip side of that is we will find animals that, you know, have the capacity, will know, able to predict which ones are going to do very well in these cities that we're throwing up all over the planet. And not only that, but we can also, by encouraging them to thrive, maybe provide some service to ourselves and maybe make our cities more habitable. And I think a great example is oysters. You know, oysters used to thrive in a lot of American cities on the coasts, and we gobbled them all up. And we kind of wish we hadn't, because they're actually great at filtering water and getting toxins out of water and you know, stopping storm surges and lots of things they can do. And so now, if we understand, you know, which oyster species might evolve well in urban environments and how we might be able to nudge their evolutions by putting them in places where the specific acidity or toxin makeup of the water suits them and might dovetail nicely with the genetic, the genes that they have and genetic potential that they have, we can grow those populations anew and kind of make our cities more livable.
The search is on for bat and frog species that live particularly well in cities because they serve a real purpose in getting rid of insects that carry disease.
That's exactly right. And so certainly frog species, I did a lot of research on this. There are some that do very well in these stormwater ponds that collect, you know, with runoff and often have lots of things like antifreeze and lots of chemicals like that in them. And they have some kind of genetic adaptation we're just beginning to understand right now. And if we can find those populations that are doing well, maybe we can encourage them to migrate to places where they're not present right now in cities and really have healthy populations of these amphibians who, as you note, are really good at controlling things like mosquitoes, which can bring all sorts of nasty diseases to our populations.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Sophia on the line in Dallas. Hi, Sophia.
Hi. I was wondering, do you think after all of these beautification projects that our insects and our fish will go back to how it was before we started so much pollution?
Do you mean after we clean up the toxic sites like Newark Bay, that sort of thing?
Yes.
What do you know about that, Brendan?
So I think it's difficult because I think that so much of the damage you've already done is at this point kind of irreparable, certainly in terms of climate change. There's no doubt that things are going to get hotter. Taking toxins out of the environment, it can be done to some extent, but it's really difficult to do 100% and turn incredibly polluted waters totally pristine. So that's maybe possible over the long run, but I think in the short term that we have to accept that we're only beginning to understand a lot of the environmental damage that we've done and that, you know, animals are going to be reacting to and adapting to what we're doing to the waterways and the forests that they're inhabiting right now.
Is there any debate among conservationists about whether it's best to focus their efforts on the animals that seem to have a shot at adapting and surviving, or it's best to focus on the ones who are close to extinction already?
Yeah, certainly. And it's almost like a generational divide in some ways, I found. You know, we were talking before about how there was this older generation of biologists who traveled the world and were working with all kinds of exotic animals. And a lot of times the way they justified their work is that, you know, the knowledge we're developing about evolutionary biology will help us in conservation efforts of these animals. And I feel like there's a younger generation that accepts that, you know what, like we've done so much damage to the environment, the animals my research mentor studied in the 1980s isn't going to make it. And so we need to think about not those animals and not investing in saving these small populations, but getting more knowledge about the animals that are going to be here with us. And trying to create almost a symbiotic relationship between humans and those species. So not only can they thrive in our cities, but we can get some benefit from them being here with us.
All right, next on the phone, let's speak with Sam in Cedar Hill, Texas. Hi, Sam.
Hello, great program, and really enjoying this, and enjoyed the article very much. And kind of on that note, could you talk a little bit about the importance of green spaces in these urban ecosystems, mm-hmm. how maybe diversity seeks those out as refuges?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, and that certainly goes back to Jason Munchie South's earliest work with white-footed mice who inhabited exclusively in New York City parks. And you find this a lot. You find this a lot where green spaces are created. There are certain species that will make their homes there and kind of adapt to the specific environment in that green space. This is certainly in big cities that have large green spaces, such as New York, that has Central Park, of course, and some other really large parks. So I do believe that green space has to be an integral part of any kind of urban development program, as much from the ground up as possible. It's tough to add it in, you know, once you've already built up glass and steel everywhere to say, well, you know, this big piece of property downtown that's worth billions of dollars, we're going to plunk a park onto it. That's just tough politically because there's so much vested interest and so many powerful interests that want to build there. So I feel that urban planners and municipal governments need to think about this very carefully as they're expanding ever outwards as their populations boom.
Is it safe to say now or appropriate to say that animals that have adapted to urban conditions and are thriving there are, in fact, in their natural habitats when they live in cities?
Yeah, this is a great philosophical question. What is nature? Is a city natural? Well, it has wildlife and it has human beings and we're affecting conditions. You know, we think of nature as pristine forests and tundras and jungles and all those kind of things. But I think it's time for us to start thinking about the places where we have our human-made abodes as being part of nature as well. And I think that requires a big philosophical shift and a big worldview shift for a lot of people who are accustomed to thinking anything that has glass and steel and concrete can't possibly be natural.
All right. Next on the phone, we have Emmanuel calling from Dallas. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hello.
Hi, are you with us?
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Will animals that live in rural areas be able to adapt to urban areas if urbanization occurred?
I think that's certainly going to be that's going to happen. That's happening right now, that a lot of animals are being swept up in urbanization, and those who don't adapt are going extinct. Unfortunately, it's only a small minority of species that are going to be able to adapt to these environments that we're creating. There's no doubt that we're part of a mass extinction event that's going on right now because of human activity. And that was something I had to be cautious about in writing the story. I didn't want people to think that this was a strictly cheery story about, oh, we don't have to worry about, you know, human activity and climate change because enough animals, enough wildlife will survive that it's all going to be okay. There is a dark undercurrent or a dark edge to what urban evolution researchers are doing. They are warning us that, you know, sure, a small percentage will adapt, and that knowledge about how they adapt and why they adapt can help us make our cities more livable and understand what species will be vulnerable to climate change. But we can't forget that we are, you know, wreaking violence on many, many millions of species right now in our drive to build and build.
How much time do these biologists think they have to get this work done before it's too late to save threatened species or make the appropriate changes?
There's certainly a sense that the clock is ticking. I will say that I was heartened by the optimism of a lot of these young researchers who've taken this up, urban evolutionary, as their life's work. I think they're doing that because they feel that between now and the end of their careers, this is a question that's going to be ongoing and something in where they can provide useful expertise and research. So I wouldn't say there is a clock ticking where we know exactly where it's going to expire and there's nothing else we can do. But there is a sense of urgency because we can see the world changing before our eyes in a much rapid way than ever before. And the people doing this research are well aware of that.
Brendan I. Kerner is a contributing editor at Wired and author of the article, How Cities Reshape the Evolutionary Path of Urban Wildlife. Brendan, thank you so much for making time to talk with us.
Thanks a million for having me, Chris.